Thank you, Father Dominic. As mentioned, my name is Father Dominic Langevin. I teach systematic theology here at the Pontifical Faculty. And it is my pleasure and honor to introduce Dr. Michelle Mulcahy, who is our first speaker this afternoon. Originally from Los Angeles, Dr. Mulcahy has studied at Rice University, the University of Toronto, where she obtained her first doctorate. And she studied, too, at the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies, also in Toronto, where she obtained her second doctorate. She has taught at the University of St. Andrews, Fordham University, St. Mary's College of California, the University of Victoria in British Columbia, and Harvard University. Dr. Mulcahy is now back at the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies in Toronto, where she holds the Leonard Boyle Chair of Manuscript Studies. Professor Mulcahy's first book is entitled First the Bow is Bent in Study, Dominican Education Before 1350. And I would say it burst onto the Dominican and medieval studies scene in 1998. And if you would permit me a personal recollection, to explain the importance of this book, I was a novice in 1998 in Cincinnati, Ohio, and somehow or another, I found a reference to this book and figured I've got to get my hands on this. Now, as a wee novice, a book that Pimps published at a price around $150 or so, which was certainly reasonable, so no complaints, but it was, let's say, beyond my means as a wee novice. But thankfully, Cincinnati had a wonderful public library. I had a card, got it on interlibrary loan, and in 3 weeks, the loan period, I gobbled down the 650 pages. It was like striking gold. Here was a little novice, first entering into Dominican education, being formed in the life, and here was a gold mine of information and wisdom about Dominican education on the academic side, but also the spiritual formation that friars of all sorts throughout Europe would have experienced in the 1200s and 1300s, from the preachers going out to the lowly friars who were staying back at home. One of my novice classmates yesterday, even not knowing that I was introducing Dr. Mulcahy, he came up to me, he said, "Did you see Michelle Mulcahy's coming? Do you remember that great book from the novitiate?" I said, "Yes, I do remember it. Here it is. It was a great, great find. I'm very happy." My novice master, he wouldn't splurge. He was known as, he was teaching us simplicity. He was not known for being a big spender, so I didn't think he would buy it. But later on, I was able to convince the librarian of the priory to buy it, and we got a copy. Everyone was happy. Apart from that wonderful book, and other many accomplishments, Dr. Mulcahy has edited a book of Dominican preaching from the 13th century in Italy, also a recent edition of Savonarola's apologetic writings from Harvard University Press. She has a forthcoming study entitled Dominican Teaching in Dante's Florence, and that will look at the Dominican schools at Santa Maria Novella in Florence. And presently, she is working on a fifth book, Jacopo Passavanti at Santa Maria Novella, Dominican Life, Learning, and Art in 14th Century Florence. With this plethora of Dominican-oriented scholarship, it could be noted that Dr. Mulcahy came to this subject not via contact with a priory or house of Dominican friars, but from a couple of individual friars who were at PIMS when she arrived there. For instance, Fathers Leonard Boyle and James Weissipel. Certainly, Dr. Mulcahy has probably had the occasion to visit other Dominican priories around the world since then, but we're very happy to have her at our Dominican Studium here in Washington for the first time. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Mulcahy as she speaks on Saint-Jacques and the Sacred Palace, the Medieval Dominicans, and the Magisterium.
Well, Well, let me begin by thanking everyone here for coming, thanking the Institute for the invitation and for the wonderful introduction. And it just put me in mind of the first review the book got that from Speculum, which the last line of was, "Shame on the Pontifical Institute Press for charging $150. So, anyway, so without further ado. So you had a lovely preamble. I'm going to tell you a couple of the same things over again. During a visit to Rome in early 1217, is this, am I okay with this? Might put lower. Okay. Thank you. During a visit to Rome in early 1217 to advocate on behalf of his small band of followers, Dominic Guzman experienced a vision. Okay. Wrong button. Thank you. In which since Peter and Paul appeared to him, Peter offered him a staff and Paul a book and showed him his preachers going two by two throughout the world. The time had come, Dominic realized, to expand their mission beyond Toulouse. Famously, Dominic chose as the first destination for his men the university towns of Europe. He sent seven brothers to Paris, personally established a community in Bologna, and 4 years later, as he lay dying, a few of his friars were making their way to Oxford. Now, why Dominic directed his men to the universities may seem obvious, but the fact is that the medieval Dominicans' own understanding of why they were there evolved over time. If they began by seeing the universities as centers of learning where they could attend classes as students and perhaps find others to join them in their work, they were soon aspiring to be teachers themselves and to membership in the university's community of masters. Once they had succeeded in gaining access to the magisterium, the Dominicans found that that was no guarantee that they would make common cause in theology with their colleagues. When first their very right to exist, let alone teach, was questioned by the secular masters who felt they were being displaced, to be followed not many years later by the condemnation of Thomas Aquinas's teaching at both Paris and Oxford. And the order was forced to reappraise its relationship with the universities once more when Dominican masters of theology started being appointed also as masters of the sacred palace, and it became all too clear that the magisterial authority claimed by the university theology faculties and the ecclesiastical authority of Pope and Council sometimes made competing demands on the friars in their practice of theology. So it's this evolving relationship with the university and the magisterium that I would like to try to trace today. There's no doubting that the first friars were concerned to acquire the learning they would need if they were to achieve their propositum of learned preaching in the service of souls. One of Dominic's earliest recorded actions, once he had gathered a few men to his project in Toulouse, was to enroll them in the classes currently being given at the Cathedral of Saint-Étienne by Alexander Stavensby, a Paris-trained master in theology. The decision to dispatch his men to the universities seems a next logical step in their training. But that simple supposition is actually a bit problematic, for it assumes that all medieval universities were equal, that all provided training in theology. Not all did, but the friars went anyway. And what this tells us about the Dominican sense of their mission, and above all, their strategy in pursuing it, is neatly illustrated by the first two destinations Dominic chose for them, Paris and Bologna. Now, the University of Paris, to which Saint-Jacques was designed to give them Dominic's orders in entree, did indeed boast the most famous theology schools in Europe. The friars sent to Paris were sent, above all else, to study at the feet of renowned masters. The seeking of new members from amongst those masters and the ranks of the friars' fellow students was certainly important and undoubtedly planned, but Paris meant training, the sort of training that would enable the friars to excel as preachers and teachers of Christian doctrine. The University of Bologna, on the other hand, was a university of law, medicine, and the arts, possessing no theology faculty. The Dominican foundation at what was then San Nicolo was designed as a preaching mission and as an important base of recruitment for the order, but it was not, in its original intention, to be a college of theology students. Now, these differing situations would have important consequences for the future work of the order in the two cities and at the two universities. The strategy for the preachers in Paris would hinge upon them becoming incorporated into the university, upon wooing into the order a regent master in theology who would bring his chair with him, give the classes held at Saint-Jacques the status of university classes, and help Dominican friars qualify as masters in theology themselves. Now, the winning of a chair was all the more imperative because a statute issued in 1213 by the Council of Paris, held under Cardinal Legate Robert de Cresson, had forbidden the regular religious of the city to leave their cloisters to attend the schools of the university. Dominic's brothers at Saint-Jacques would be forever barred from participating in the university's curriculum if a Parisian master could not be found and persuaded to hold his lectures physically within the walls of the preacher's house. Securing the services of Master John of St. Albans, as they did in 1221, was only a temporary solution. The friars needed masters of their own if the future of Dominican education at the University of Paris was to be safeguarded. In Bologna, it was quite otherwise. Rather than fighting for incorporation, the Dominicans would ultimately find the university turning to them in the 1360s to supply the theology faculty it still lacked. The friars opened the door of their studium to the university. Now, this explains the vocabulary in the Dominicans Constitutiones Antiquae of 1220, which referred to Paris as the order's sole studium, even though the friars had been in Bologna just as long. Saint-Jacques was the only convent where the friars could be put in touch with advanced theological training. The Dominicans would soon succeed, in fact, in securing not one, but two chairs of theology there in a story often told. Secular Master John of St. Giles had taken over the teaching duties in Saint-Jacques. Under him, Friar Roland of Cremona, a former regent master of arts at Bologna, became the first member of the order to incept as a master of theology in Paris. Roland established his chair at Saint-Jacques alongside that of his former teacher, and the Dominicans' theological future at the university seemed secure. It was made doubly so when John of St. Giles himself followed Roland into the Dominican order in very public fashion. In the midst of preaching a sermon on voluntary poverty at Saint-Jacques, he gave dramatic emphasis to his words by descending from the pulpit, receiving the Dominican habit, and returning to finish his sermon as a friar preacher. That made two chairs, and as of 1230, the school at Saint-Jacques was undeniably a part of the theological faculty at the University of Paris. Saint-Jacques thus became the focal point of the order's efforts to create a core of teachers under their own masters in theology. The general chapter determined that every year, each province could send two of its men to study at Saint-Jacques, who would then come home and work as lectors in local convents. Saint-Jacques also ensured a steady supply of credentialed masters for the order, because unlike their secular counterparts, who often remained in Paris for their entire careers, Dominican masters served as regents only for the 2 years it took them to train another friar as his bachelor, to see him incept as a master, and then relinquish his chair to him. John of St. Giles' former chair became known as the intern chair, to be filled by men of the French province, while Roland Cremona's chair came to be known as the extern chair, to which the other provinces had access in a set rotation. Soon, the majority of the Dominicans' masters were French, while most of the other provinces had to manage with a single man qualifying for them every 10 years or so when it came their turn. It would be nearly 30 years before the Roman province in Italy had its first native-born master in theology when Thomas Aquinas incepted in Paris. But the Gallic emphasis did ultimately lead to a special relationship with the Avignese papacy between the popes and Dominican masters, as we shall see. Well, as the order grew, what's happening here? Sorry, we shouldn't be there yet. I'm leaning on things, gave away the surprise. So as the orders grew, the pressures on Saint-Jacques became untenable, and in 1248, the decision was taken to create four additional studia to spread the burden. Interestingly, only one was to be located at a university where the Dominicans intended to work toward affiliation with a theological faculty, as it had done at Paris. And that was the studium organized at Blackfriars in Oxford. A situation similar to Saint-Jacques soon obtained there, when Robert Bacon, a regent master in theology, brought his chair with him when he entered the order at Blackfriars, heralding a membership in the theological faculty for the Dominicans that he further guaranteed by presiding over the inception of Friar Richard Fishacre. But the other three studia generalia created in 1248 were erected at Bologna, Montpellier, and at Cologne, and in none of these instances was the intention to establish institutional ties with an extant university. Bologna's lack of a theological faculty has already been noted, so why elevate its status in the order's hierarchy of studies now? Well, it had as much to do with the overall importance of the priory within the broader life and organization of the order as it did with proximity to the university per se. Dominic had made Bologna one of the major administrative centers of the order. In the early years, the general chapters had alternated between Saint-Jacques and Saint-Nicolo. The Bologna priory still boasted one of the largest communities in the order and had the financial resources to support an international student body. The friars there also continued to reap a rich harvest of vocation from amongst the men of the university. And it was essential, we're now in Bologna. The Bologna prior still boasted one of the largest communities. The friars also continued to reap a rich harvest of vocation from amongst the men of the university, and it was essential that these promising minds be redirected into the study of theology. And lastly, if symbolically, Dominic was buried there in the church that now bore his name. San Domenico was many things, but it was not a route to the magisterium for Dominic's sons. As for Montpellier, it too hosted a university that did not include a faculty of theology. Its fame rested on a faculty of medicine that had connections to Salerno. The reasons the Dominicans went there was because Montpellier was in the south of France, in the former heartland of the Cathar movement, and the order's leaders thought it important that the friars provide classes in theology at this university in particular, where they could draw learned men away from any lingering erroneous beliefs, perhaps even into the order. The studium at the University of Montpellier was quite literally a missionary outpost. Cologne in 1248 was in its twilight as a cathedral school town. Developments that had ushered in the age of the university elsewhere had largely passed it by. The Dominicans' choice of their convent of Heilige Kreuz as the site for one of their new general houses of study was prompted largely by geography, the need to find a home for a studium somewhere in the province of Germany to service the northeastern sector of the order, and also perhaps because Albert the Great was ready to go home and he took young Thomas Aquinas with him. But a secular university was not even part of the equation. So all this is a long way of saying that the Dominicans headed to the universities with a variety of purposes in mind, and the relationship with no two was the same. Nor did the Dominicans locate their own most important studia exclusively at universities, as becomes ever clearer as the 13th century wore on, and each province was charged with establishing a studium generale within its borders. The assumption that the Dominican order was only interested in taking the theological faculties by storm and making masters of its own men, in other words, that the magisterium was the goal, is equally wide of the mark. But by virtue of their participation in the theological faculties of Paris and Oxford, the friars were indeed now part of the magisterium. How did they understand that reality? Well, in this period, belonging to the magisterium simply meant being an active member of a guild of regent masters, that is, of an universitas magistrorum, masters collectively exercising their vocation as teachers, is the medieval magisterium in action. Some masters were more equal than others. Those who had their degrees from smaller regional centers of learning could not readily transfer their skills elsewhere. But members of Universitatis Magistrorum at the great centers with international reputations, like Paris and Oxford, had credentials known as licentia docendi ubique, licenses to teach that were recognized everywhere, a reflection of the quality of the training they had received and the standards their guilds upheld. And over time, the professional opinions of these masters, in some rather impressionistic sense, began to carry more weight than those of others. Now, this was as true for other disciplines as it was for theology. They, too, had guilds of masters who are correctly referred to as the magisterium of their discipline. But there was a certain preeminence that the queen of the sciences enjoyed, and thus at those universities where there were theological faculties, the earliest decades of their history are punctuated by conflicts in which the theologians tried to have the last word in those matters where fields were seen to overlap. The most spectacular confrontations bring our focus right back to Paris, where the ongoing recovery of Aristotelian philosophy had put the masters of the arts faculties and the theologians at odds, not only regarding the correct interpretation of Aristotle, but in their very definitions of where the limits of philosophical inquiry should be drawn. And here we need to acknowledge something else that set Paris apart from the other universities, something arguably upon which the Dominicans consciously capitalized. The University of Paris, unlike the secular universities of Italy or some of the later royal foundations in the north, had grown out of the cathedral school of Notre Dame. The Bishop of Paris still retained some vestigial control of the appointment of the theology masters. Even if the masters themselves now oversaw the examinations of those who sought admission to their ranks, a formal ceremonial approval of each candidate by the bishop or his chancellor was still required before any candidate could incept as a master. And one obvious corollary was that the Bishop of Paris saw monitoring and maintaining the orthodoxy of the university as part of his mandate, a sensitivity the theology masters could play on when they did not like what they were hearing coming out of the arts faculties, or indeed from certain members of their own faculty. The theologians could appeal to the bishop as the personification of ecclesiastical authority in theological matters, or even to the pope to try to force the bishop's hand in condemning doctrines they found suspect. At the risk of oversimplifying, that is what is behind the first ban on the teaching of Aristotle by the Council of Sens in 1210, Bishop Étienne Tempier's condemnation in 1270 of specific Aristotelian and Averroistic tenets, especially monopsychism, and even the famous condemnation of 1277, namely, theologians agitating with the bishop against their competitors in the arts faculty. The dynamic is worth observing because this is precisely where the seeds were sown for an eventual contest of wills between ecclesiastical authority and magisterial authority in theological matters. The condemnations themselves were issued by the ecclesiastical authorities, acting on their ancient identity as teachers of doctrine and enforcers of the decisions of councils, but increasingly they were doing so on the basis of magisterial advice. An early precedent was set at the Fourth Lateran Council in affirming Peter Lombard's Trinitarian doctrine. Pope Innocent III had not made the council an arena for discussion, but simply asked the gathered church leaders to ratify the findings of the university masters. It is not surprising, then, that those masters began to believe that perhaps their opinion should be considered in some sense authoritative in its own right. Thomas Aquinas, half a century later, readily made a distinction between the magisterium cathedrae pontificalis and the magisterium cathedrae magistralis. The preeminence of Paris's theology masters meant not only that when theological issues were debated there, the arguments and resolutions were noted everywhere, it meant that how their relationship with the ecclesiastical hierarchy was expressed in those resolutions also became normative for the professional practice of theology. Now, all these factors explain a number of things the Dominicans did through their presence at Saint-Jacques. Not only working so hard so soon to become regent masters at the University of Paris in order to have a voice in such things, but also recognizing the advantages of multiplying the number of masters they trained up through the system. This not only had the obvious advantage of providing staff and advisors for the regional schools back in the province, It provided men who kept the provinces abreast of the most recent developments in theology at the university, and as Parisian masters, they could speak with a certain gravitas that was fast becoming a recognized authority, and in their ever-growing numbers, they became an important register in that magisterial voice. Dramatic pause. So this might be the juncture at which to point out a parallel reality that was just starting to emerge in the same decades, namely the papal Studium Curiae and the office of Master of the Sacred Palace. Here, the Dominicans soon had a virtual monopoly on what came to be the other great locus of theological authority in the High Middle Ages, as popes began consistently preferring Dominican friars to all others as their magistri sacri palatii. So what did being Master of the Sacred Palace imply? Well, it all began with Pope Innocent IV, who in 1244 or 1245 decided to create a studium at the Curia, which was to be a school of law and theology that would travel with the popes as they made their annual progress. It was designed to serve those permanently posted to the Curia as officials and also men drawn temporarily to the Curia on business from all over Europe by offering lectures and edifying sermons. Now, from the start, Innocent was apparently looking to the universities as a model for his own educational enterprise and for vocabulary. He refers to the masters he appoints to teach in his studium as faculty, and also as its regents, for example. But it's clear that this Studium Curiae did not function quite like a university. While its theology masters might offer lectures and dispute, they did not formally enroll students, they did not train bachelors or examine candidates for degrees, and at no time did the medieval Studium Curiae grant teaching licenses. The only instances of individuals being raised to the magisterium at the Curia for which we have evidence are those in which it was done by papal fiat, as when Pope Benedict XI in 1304 granted licenses in theology to three friars, one Franciscan, one Augustinian, one Dominican, all of whom Benedict was at pains to point out had studied at Paris and had met all the requirements there. Thus, the Studium Curiae, despite being a papal creation, was not designed as a self-perpetuating embodiment of the magisterium. But the situation changed profoundly in the first quarter of the 14th century. The first hint comes in 1312, when the Council of Vienne lists the Studium Curiae as being of the same rank as the universities of Paris, Bologna, Salamanca, and Oxford. As the century wore on, various papal bulls began to refer to the Studium Curiae as the Universitas Sacri Palatii. The watershed moment in this development, as with so much of the bureaucratic growth of the Curia, appears to coincide with the relocation of the papacy to Avignon. It was in Avignon that the master in theology at the Studium Curiae was formally made an officer of the Roman Curia for the first time, and given the title by which we still know him today, the Master of the Sacred Palace, which may have everything to do with the fact that for the first time there was a permanent palace in which the Curia resided year-round. But with this new status came new responsibilities, including service as papal legate. Guillaume de Pierre Godin, a Dominican friar and the first master of the Studium Curiae after the arrival in Avignon, was sent on a diplomatic mission to Paris in 1308. In 1317, Guillaume's successor, Durand de Saint-Pourçain, another Dominican, was given a similar assignment, as was Durand's successor, Dominican Guillaume de Laudon. The brief is interesting, but those three names even more so, all French, Paris-trained, Dominican masters. A second duty that becomes a prominent part of the theology master's portfolio, and the one that we associate most readily with the Master of the Sacred Palace today, is as advisor to the Pope in theological matters. Pope John XXII famously sought the advice of his Master of the Sacred Palace, the Dominican Armand de Belvezer, on the subject of the beatific vision. A commission of 14 university masters had already met under Cardinal Annibaldo Gaetani in September of 1333 to review a number of questionable propositions and found several tenets to be erroneous, but wishing to be doubly sure in a matter that touched directly upon his own theory of the beatific vision, John XXII asked his current master of the Sacred Palace to review the commission's findings and render the final judgment. So there are two things to note about the papal Studium Curiae as it evolved in the 14th century. The first is that roll call of Dominicans who held the position of master of the Sacred Palace. It was indeed a near monopoly by the friars. The second is the Pope's increasing concern to make their studium look as much like a university as they could. On one level, this was simply a reflection of how influential the most prominent educational model in Europe was. But on another, it is witness to the fact that over the same years that the Studium Curiae developed, the authority of the university masters was gradually being acknowledged. The popes wanted to ensure that the teachers in their studium should also be seen to represent the magisterium, not only as the papally appointed advisors in theological matters, but as members of a magisterial body analogous to that of a university. By the early 14th century, then, there were three places in which theological authority resided: in the determinations of popes and councils, the magisterium of the universities, and now this third, the master of the Sacred Palace, that blended ecclesiastical and magisterial authority in a new way. The medieval Dominicans' relationship with the magisterium was thus a bit more complicated than one might think. Another dramatic pause. Just how complicated was brought into sharp focus for the friars by one episode in particular, involving Durand de Saint-Porsan, whose name you've heard and who wound up at the center of the longest-lasting theological controversy in the Dominican Order's history. Oh, well, I looked. Durand's is perhaps the landmark case of a Dominican friar indicted by his own order for his views. And it forced the Dominicans to articulate where exactly they understood theological authority to lie. For at the time his confreres accused him of heresy, Durand was serving as master of the Sacred Palace. Durand's case also compelled the order to decide once and for all whether the theological standard to which it intended to hold its friars was going to be Thomas Aquinas, which raised the question of whether Thomas's teaching could be shown to embody doctrinal authority, whether deviance from Aquinas's thought was going to be merely inconvenient to the order's harmony or could actually be deemed heretical. Now, Durand first came to the notice of his Dominican superiors around 1307, when a youthful commentary on the sentences of Peter Lombard he had composed began to attract some negative attention. The problem was that Durand disagreed with Thomas Aquinas on some fundamental points in metaphysics and Trinitarian theology. His text was almost certainly the catalyst that led the Dominican General Chapter of 1309 to issue its very first advisory encouraging the order's teachers to concentrate on Aquinas' doctrine with their students. They also told Durand to submit a revised version of his commentary for inspection. Thus we come to the second recension of Durand of Saint-Porsan's sentences commentary, which stems from his reading of the sentences as a bachelor at Saint-Jacques in Paris in 1310 and 1311. It was a compliant rewriting that seemed to mollify his superiors, for Durand was allowed to incept as a master of theology, right on schedule, in 1312. He only occupied the position of regent for a few months, however, because Pope Clement V named him master of the Sacred Palace, and he was soon on his way to Avignon, where he would teach and advise the popes, first Clement and then John XXII, for the next 4 years. Durand of Saint-Porsan's promotion to the Sacred Palace seems to put order on the defensive, however, for within weeks, the next Dominican chapter responded with an official endorsement of the doctrine of Thomas Aquinas across the board and took steps to silence any dissenting voice in the order. As one such measure, Master General Berenguer of Landora appointed a commission to inquire into the orthodoxy of Durand's sentences commentary in both its versions. Their examination yielded 93 suspect theses, which were condemned on the 3rd of July, 1314. Now, Durand was given an opportunity either to defend his opinions or withdraw them. He soon produced a work known as the Excusationes, in which he questioned the legal validity of the censure, as well as defending the content of his teaching. The lead investigator on the commission, Hervaeus Natalis, replied with his Reprobationes Excusationem Durandi, in which he denied Durand's appeal on what he saw as essentially procedural grounds. Now, this exchange did little to calm the rising storm, however, largely because Durand and Hervaeus had been carrying on their own very public debate through a series of quadlibetal disputations. Hervaeus was actually the regent master under whom Durand had trained at Saint-Jacques and had been the one who first raised the alarm about Durand's opinions even before that, taking them on in a quadlibetal disputation in 1307. Once he'd become a master himself, Durand responded through quadlibets of his own, first in Paris, then in Avignon at the Studium Curiae. Thus, while Durand was careful to observe the forms in acknowledging his order's censure, the views that had earned him the reprimand in the first place were still very much on display. A second inquiry into Durand's writings was begun in 1317. This time, the investigators produced a censure list of 235 theses found in Durand's sentences commentary that were not so much heterodox as untomistic. The new list was made mandatory reading for the order's students, and in any manuscripts the friars might still have of Durand's commentary, the proposed corrections were to be written right into the margins at the appropriate places. And Durand did not respond immediately to the second censure. In fact, he waited until he had become a bishop and stood in a different relationship to his order's authorities and their power to censure him. He had finished a third revision of his commentary by about 1327. In this final rendition, Durand can be seen refining his vocabulary, but reasserting his original views and his right to theological independence. Durand of Saint-Pourçain died on the 10th of September, 1334, without having had a formal reply from his order. Now, the Durand affair is most often used as an index of the evolution of the Dominican order's commitment to the thought of Aquinas. But in the time remaining, I'd like to examine instead what Durand of Saint-Pourçain's case reveals about the Dominicans' understanding of the relationship between ecclesiastical authority and theological practice. And we can begin by looking at how the Dominican leaders justified the first censure of Durand. If we look closely at the wording of the 1313 advisory with which the general chapter attempted to establish a doctrinal imperative for the order, we can begin to connect the dots between that censure and the legislation that was designed to enable it. The admonitio says, and I quote, "We strictly prohibit that any friar, when lecturing, determining, or responding, should dare to assert anything contrary to what is generally credited to the opinion of the aforesaid doctor, Aquinas, or to repeat or affirm any singular opinion in those matters that are seen to pertain to faith or morals against the common teaching of the doctors, unless for the purpose of disproving such opinions or as objections to be responded to immediately." Now, Durand himself had used similar phraseology in his first sentences commentary, claiming he was merely repeating an opinio singularis, not necessarily promoting it. So for the chapter to invoke that very scenario is clearly telegraphing that Durand is the intended target here. But the contrast that is being made in the advisory between the common teaching of the doctors and a novel opinion is noteworthy on another level. What is being stressed is precisely the difference between the opinion shared by the majority of the active masters in theology on a given issue and any new interpretation that had yet to gain wide acceptance. By this period, magisterial opinion, the dicta magistralia, were beginning to be accorded some degree of theological authority, and the Dominican legislation of 1313 actually witnesses to the transition. Thus, the first challenge for the Dominican leaders, if they wished to impugn the teaching of Durand of Saint-Pourçain, was to demonstrate that he was not part of the scholarly consensus. The next challenge, if they wished to hold Thomas Aquinas up as the standard against which the order's teacher were going to be measured, was to demonstrate that Thomas was part of the consensus. Well, Durand opens his self-defense in his excusationes by attempting, first, to undermine the censure's legal status, arguing that due process has not been observed. He objects that the censured articles have been extracted from a work that he himself did not publish, therefore there was no act of disobedience. He also claims that in many instances the commission willfully misread his meaning. In Article 1, for example, concerning the nature of the distinction between the divine essence and relation in the Trinity, Durand insists that he did not simply say, as quoted in the censure, that the divine essence is distinct from the persons and their relationship. He said that they are in some way, aliquo modo, distinct, insofar as they are not adequately and conversely the same. Thus, the error of maintaining that essence and relation are really distinct cannot be imputed to him, because the conditionality he attached to that statement was ignored by his accusers. At other junctures, Durand challenges the charge of outright heresy by arguing that no statement contrary to the tenet the commission is questioning is found in either the scriptures or the councils, and thus the main criterion for heresy has not been met. Another strategy Durand employs is to distinguish between what was said in his commentary assertive and what was said recitative or disputative, a direct allusion to the 1313 advisory. Friars are not to assert a problematic opinion, but may repeat it in order to dispute it. The suspect views, says Durand, appear only for the purposes of discussion. Now, if Durand were right on any of these counts, the censure would be on shaky ground. Hervaeus Natalis's reprobationes thus become an exercise in defending his commission's modus operandi, an exposition of the bases on which it is judging Durand. In his cross-examination, Hervaeus asks four questions of each contested proposition. 1. What has the church determined on the issue? 2. What does Durand claim in his writings? 3. How does Durand justify this claim? And 4. Is his current justification sufficient to exonerate his earlier view? Well, Hervaeus remains generally unconvinced by Durand's attempts to explain himself. He sees a basic incoherence between Durand's current defense and what he stated assertive in his previous works. Hervaeus argues, for example, that Durand did teach the postulate of a real distinction of the persons of the Trinity assertive, and for the following reasons. First, Durand supports the thesis of real distinction with a greater number of arguments than he adduces against it, and without responding to them, while he does respond to the arguments contra. And secondly, he reduces all other opinions to this thesis. Thirdly, the thesis of real distinction determines his response to the opposing arguments. Hervaeus does note, interestingly, one ground on which he might be willing to give Durand some leeway. Out of respect for the magisterium, he admits that Durand could appeal to the difference in his academic status at the time he wrote those earlier immature opinions and now as a master in theology. But Hervaeus forestalls even this by showing that Durand has not, in fact, changed the basic orientation of his earlier position in reformulating it the way he did as a magisterial determination. More striking is what Hervaeus has to say to Durand about the church's authority and magisterial authority in the sphere of theological practice. In the preface to Article 7, Hervaeus suggests that a theologian's license to determine on any particular question depends on whether the question concerns an article of faith or is a matter of common opinion. In the first case, concerning, say, questions on the Trinity or the divine procession, the sort of questions under scrutiny in Durand's case, a theologian must not respond merely recitative, but always assertive and in overt agreement with the church, with what the church has established. Anything less, says Hervaeus, should be liable to a charge of heresy. And he devotes considerable energy to arguing the church has pronounced authoritatively, if implicitly, on some of the issues in play. The second case concerns questions that have not been officially determined by the church, but on which there is a recognizable magisterial consensus. The theologian is then advised to prefer that opinion that agrees more with what has been commonly accepted. a preference for one's own opinion, the opinio singularis, over the interpretation of the maior pars, is at best, Hervaeus scolds, indicative of a presumptuous intellect. And here he works hard to demonstrate that there is a scholarly consensus that Durand has ignored. In an arresting contrast, Durand's prologue to the final recension of his sentences commentary will offer a more autonomous view of the professional practice of theology. According to Durand, when the issue does not directly concern an article of faith, the theologian's claims must be grounded on rational argument, not on some misplaced sense of obligation to recent scholarship. Durand sees intellectual hubris not in the individual's independent search for truth, but in daring to place the authority of a modern teacher before that of the church fathers. Undue deference to magisterial opinion hinders impartial inquiry, says Durand, and he, for his part, places greater value on assenting to reason than to human authority. Well, if Hervaeus' reprobationes is primarily an articulation of the procedures and definitions the commission was bringing to bear in the case, a second, more theological tract Hervaeus wrote takes on the controverted issues directly. In his De Articulis, Hervaeus seeks to disprove Durand's main arguments. Without diverting us too far into the specific theological issues, I would simply draw attention to one feature of the De Articulis, and that's Hervaeus's heavy reliance on magisterial authority as opposed to ecclesiastical authority throughout his rebuttal of Durand. But tellingly, Hervaeus uses Aquinas's account of the Trinity, and more importantly, Aquinas's account of the dual procession of the Holy Spirit, as if it did conform to the received opinion. Indeed, part of Hervaeus's sleight of hand is that he interprets Thomas in such a way, with a little help from Duns Scotus, that he makes him sound more in tune with the scholarly conversation than he really is. And thus, Hervaeus is implying that Aquinas's teaching on the subject can and should be accepted as in some sense authoritative because he represents the magisterial mainstream. This is the larger campaign that second-generation Thomists like Hervaeus were mounting to introduce a normative use of Thomas Aquinas's teaching by finding ways to incorporate it into the common opinion of the doctors. And that is the real significance of the second censure of Durand that would follow in 1317, in which Durand's views are judged now strictly against Thomistic criteria. Durand of Saint-Pourçain was being shown to have done something far worse than failing to follow an advisory about what not to teach. Durand was being shown to have erred theologically by failing to acknowledge Aquinas's work, which is to say, the magisterium's judgment, as normative, and believing it was open to criticism. For Durand himself, however, the 1317 censure represents a tendentious act of obscurantism on his order's part, with the Dominican authorities trying to impose what he saw as the fallible doctrine of a contemporary teacher over the authority of the fathers and at the expense of open scientific inquiry. Now, the fact that Durand of Saint-Pourçain was a master of the sacred palace during the climactic phase of his dispute with his order tells us something, then, about how the friars viewed the theological authority of the sacred palace in the mid-14th century. In fact, the nearly 20-year-long conflict between Durand of Saint-Pourçain and his order affords a window on a number of interrelated phenomena. The rise of Thomism as a recognized school of thought within the Dominican order, certainly, but also the Dominicans' understanding of the scope and legitimacy of the theologian's profession, of the relationship between magisterial and ecclesiastical authority and their own internal disciplinary mechanisms, and how the definition of error might fall between those three stools. Because it made the friars contemplate all these things, the dispute with Durand can perhaps be counted as the most important chapter in the construction of the Dominicans' intellectual identity and their understanding of the university's place within it in their order's 800-year history. I thank you for your patience.
We have some time now for questions. If you would, please raise your hand, and either Brother Antoninus or myself will be able to give you a microphone.
Myself.
Well, I'll go ahead and ask a question then. You mentioned, Dr. Mulcahy, that with John the 22nd and the question of the beatific vision, there was a Dominican who was the master of the sacred palace already at that time. Mm-hmm. But from my understanding, both the Dominicans and the Franciscans as corporate bodies protested and acted against the declaration, the bull of John the 22nd, saying that the beatific vision was delayed. How did that work out between that, I don't remember the name of the Dominican who is the master of the Sacred Palace.
Armand de Valdeza.
How did that work out between him, his boss, the Pope, and the order?
Well, I oversimplified things for the sake of trying to point out how the Pope was viewing his master of the Sacred Palace, and that he could turn to his theologian and consider that what John the 22nd was doing is showing how he regarded the status of his master of the Sacred Palace, that the final arbiter in these things, as far as he was concerned, was going to be the say-so of the Pope as advised by his theologian. We know it didn't work out that way. The other thing I suppressed is the fact that some of the views that were being reviewed by that commission of 14 university masters included 7 by Durand of Saint-Pourçain. But I wanted to, so Durand, interestingly enough, was on 2 sides of the fence as far as the popes were concerned with his authority. On the one hand, Clement V, who first appointed him, did so when he knew he was under the cloud of censure from his own order. So the appointment was made in full knowledge that there was already some inquiry into Durand's theology. But Clement is obviously viewing that as simply an internal disciplinary affair, a censure with jurisdiction extending only so far, coterminous with the Dominican order, and that it did not have any impact whatsoever on his view of Durand as a theologian. The important thing for Clement was to get the best bright young minds out of Paris, and Durand was the most recently minted master of theology in Paris, and he was obviously whipping up some interesting discussions. So we have Clement on the one hand, in the teeth of the Dominican censure, going ahead and hiring Durand of Saint-Pourçain. And then when we get to John the 22nd subsequently, Durand is now on this particular issue, although John found him a theologian whose lead he followed in a number of things, that is Durand. In this particular issue, he wasn't so happy. And Durand is indeed on the wrong side of the commission's findings regarding the beatific vision. But at the same time, his now successor, Armand, is fighting against the commission. So what we have, I think, in the end, is some sort of graph of what the popes are seeing as the mandate of their masters of the Sacred Palace. And then the problem is trying to see how the waves, the sort of seismic waves, are being actually received by the orders, by the university matters, and everybody else. And that's why I find it so interesting and so complicated, is you do have these sort of vying claims to authority, but in some instances they're based on each other's expertise. Like, my master of the Sacred Palace should be listened to because he's one of you guys. He's a master from the university. But he's my guy, so when he disagrees with you masters from the university, you should listen to him. So it's to me it becomes a very interesting sort of waltz that goes on for a generation or more.
Could you comment on the censures of Thomas Aquinas' writings? Mm-hmm. So you have Paris, Stephen Tempier, but also Robert Kilwardby in England, who himself was a Dominican. And former provincial of the English province, mm-hmm. and how what light that sheds on sort of the order's responses to those censures mm-hmm. and the relationship between sort of the order understanding itself as having a kind of theological tradition that it's responsible for versus the bishops taking some care over the universities and what's taught there.
Yeah, exactly. This is precisely what I'm trying to get at in the sort of, you know, the nebulousness of some of these questions in their own eyes. Because if we look at the case of Kilwardby and the condemnations, when the order is trying to get that smoothed out, their response is to promote him out of the fray. They have him made cardinal, basically. So he's not Archbishop of Canterbury anymore and has no say as a member of the hierarchy of the English Church over the University of Oxford or its theological faculty or anything else. Notice the same thing that Durand does when he finally decides to put in writing what he really thinks in his third recension of his sentences commentary. He does so when he's a bishop and he stands in a different relationship to the authority of his order. So there's obviously a very fine dance that's going on between their understanding of all these things, magisterial consensus and their own order's sense of a doctrinal imperative and ecclesiastical authority. But what's interesting when you look at the censure of Durand, and this reflects on what you're asking about by way of the condemnation of Thomas, is you can see the steps by which they're tightening the screws, the leadership, insofar as the first censure is basically a question of disobedience. Front and center in the accusation against Durand has very little to do with the content of what he says, although it does. The thing that they're trying to hang him on is the fact that he has flouted the order's regulations regarding publication, that he did not get permission to publish his sentences commentary. Since the 1250s, there had been on the books regulations that required any Dominican author to get the permission of his provincial prior, who would convoke a committee of experts, and the works would be vetted before they could be published. Durand was accused of flouting that. His defense was that he didn't publish them. He, in fact, refers to the fact that his writings were stolen and circulated without his knowledge. But you can see the sort of parallel by which they start with the accusations they think they can hold while they're continuing to increase the sense of creating an intellectual identity. So at the time he's accused in the first censure of disobedience, and there's this problem with the things he disagrees on with Thomas, the only thing on the books as far as the doctrinal imperative from the order at that point, in 1309, the only thing the Dominicans said in their legislation was that they would encourage their teachers to concentrate with Aquinas on Aquinas with their students to make sure that the students, if called upon, would be able to defend their man's doctrine. It's very gentle. By the time we get to the second censure, in some ways they realize that the problem of disobedience is not working in terms of the catching on the hook of publication, but they have now increased the stringency of the insistence on the doctrine of Aquinas. The 1313 advisory, which I read part of, continues by saying, not only do we espouse the doctrine of Aquinas, and not only should this be the only thing that's taught at Certive in class, it goes on to say, and anyone who doesn't do this will be punished so severely that they're made an example of. And that's the context in which the censure of Durand actually then takes place, is he's being censured at this point on a doctrinal imperative. But when you look at somebody like the Pope, like Clement V, he sees that still strictly as an internal disciplinary matter. The Dominican magisterium, if you want to refer to it in those terms, the Pope is not convinced that there's anything beyond a disciplinary action still taking place. So when you see those condemnations of Aquinas in 1277, to me what's interesting is the real catalyst that gets the order to start thinking in terms of intellectual identity, to start legislating in terms of intellectual identity, in terms of going into the classrooms and telling the teachers what to do and how to do it, and honoring Aquinas' opinion. That's in response to Durand. It's not in response to the condemnations of 1277. That's a sort of, you know, the outsiders, and that's one thing, and they fought the good fight in terms of defending the doctrine, and they did so until the man was canonized in 1323. But the fact is, the thing that really got the legislative juices flowing for the Dominicans themselves was this internal dispute, not the problem of the condemnation. But in both these issues, both these battles, the question of your status vis-a-vis your order as a friar and what you could say once you were part of the hierarchy, they were clearly two different things, as Kilwardby illustrates and as Durand illustrates, and then the whole question of papal appointment illustrates.
Do we have time? It's okay. So this is an
very, this is a question posed with great ignorance of the development of the magisterium, but I was just thinking, as you were talking about the Master of the Sacred Palace and the beginning of a kind of university criteria, when we look, of course, today at the modern Holy Office, we have our eminent representative in the room, there's the what you see develop is the alliance between the, I mean, the understanding of a university formation criteria of a person or persons who have a formation in theology at, you know, elevated academic levels, allied with the episcopacy, so that you go back. I mean, because what things what I found fascinating is that you're showing the instability of the notion of where the authority is going, and they're sort of trying to give the university regents or the university professors the kind of almost they're kind of getting involved in the episcopal deliberations. We see now more of an alliance of those two, which helps settle things. But I'm wondering, because I'm still thinking, of course, the Master of the Sacred Palace is still a priest, typically, but he doesn't have the authority that it seems like is sort of going on in these situations. I mean, I also know that in the Minerva in Rome, there was, I think, 16th century, you know, a lot of Dominicans who ran the Holy Office, and I don't think they were bishops. I'm not sure.
So no, I don't think so, particularly not in the case of Galileo, no.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sort of wondering how, if you could speak to this question of when, how does the episcopacy and the magisterium of the doctor scholars get fused? I mean, is that a modern development? Or?
Modern in terms of the period we're looking at here, but not modern in the way you're probably thinking. I think by the time we get to the 15th century even, we're beginning to have, the popes have succeeded in basically creating a pontifical university. So there is, as opposed to the single master in theology and his master in law and his master in canon law, there is a faculty, and we can start talking in those sorts of terms. There is a student body. There are all the sort of trappings of institutional identity that is completely absent in these earlier phases that I was describing. So the mere fact that you have a sort of pontifical university is part of the success. And then it's fused with an older idea, and that is the cathedral school, that in essence the earliest theology masters that were operating at the diocesan level were holding benefices by the grace of the bishops, by episcopal appointment. And that's what happens in the 15th century with the pontifical university, is it is seen, in some ways they roll back the clock to see this in the same guise that the cathedral schools used to be, that the representatives of the faculty have their appointment by virtue of a different sort of relationship with the bishop than they did in the earliest days of the traveling school that Innocent had in mind. So I think it's those two things. The fact in I think 15th century is the locus, the fact that it is succeeding, they are succeeding in creating something that really is a pontifical university as opposed to the in-house sort of advisory studium idea, and that is allied with appointments that are made quite overtly as episcopal appointments.
I think we need to bring this session to an end. If you would please join me in thanking Dr. Mulcahy for an enlightening talk.